It's good to see everybody this morning. good to see our visitors. We're going to talk about the kings in this class. The kings get us to King Saul and King David today and talk about some really good stuff. We really need to get to talking about the second quarter or this next quarter for December that starts. So this quarter will end at the end of this month. And so I was thinking about, we got 3 weeks, I think, technically 3 weeks. So if you're one of the teachers, and I don't remember who all is not teaching now, who's ready to start teaching in December, we need to start talking about that. So we'll try to make an announcement during the worship period of time. In fact, can you add that to the announcements? That'd be great. So we were talking about the judges, and I didn't really give you the detail of all the judges. I think there's 12, 13 total judges. Some are considered minor just because of the content, but they were nonetheless appointed, called by God during the period of the judges. About a 350-year period of time, approximately. Well, we get to the book of Ruth, and Ruth is a book that's found also in the period of the judges, and it's during that time that we read about a family of Ephrathites, Naomi's family, and they, because of the struggles in the promised land, would leave the promised land and go to Moab. Go to Moab. In verse 2 of Ruth chapter 1, you'll see that. And the sons of Naomi and her husband will all die in the land of Moab, and yet they had taken wives of the Moabitish women. And Ruth is that woman, is the one that stands out here. One was Orpah, but Ruth is the one that stands out and becomes so important to the Bible because of one thing, primarily one thing. And so if I were to ask that, what is that one thing that Ruth is so important for remembering? There you go. David's grandmother, lineage of Christ. That being the case, what are we talking about in the big scheme of things? Look at Matthew chapter 1. And y'all know this. Matthew chapter 1. And look at Matthew chapter 1, verse 5. And lo and behold, who do we find in that verse? Rahab, and who else? Ruth. Ruth, a Moabitish woman. Rahab, what kind of woman was she? A harlot. And both of these ladies end up being in the genealogy of Jesus the Christ, the one who would be the Redeemer and is the Redeemer of the entire world. And so this four-chapter book on Ruth is so important. It talks about the principle of a kindred Redeemer, a law that was provided in the law of Moses to replace the offspring of a deceased one, where the lineage or line could continue. And yet the principle there of a kindred Redeemer becomes something that even in and of itself is, I believe, redemptive. So Jesus is our kindred Redeemer. I'm not related to Jesus that I know of through genealogical DNA. Maybe I am, I don't know. But I don't think I'm Asian, and I don't think I'm close to the Hebraic bloodlines, but it doesn't matter. Spiritually, Jesus is the Redeemer for all mankind. And through the seed of truth, the Word of God, we are again blessed through that genealogy. And so that's a very interesting study. Well, that gets us to the book of 1 Samuel. And in 1 Samuel, we're reading about this Hannah, and who has a son named Samuel. Remember, Hannah, though, is in a polygamous relationship. Well, she's not. Her husband is, I guess, but I guess it would serve the same. And Elkanah has two wives. And the first there is Peninnah, or however you want to say that, has children, but Hannah has no children. And we see that Elkanah was a faithful man and that he went up to the city yearly to worship at Shiloh. Shiloh is the location of where the tabernacle was. Remember, the temple has not been built yet. They're still with the tabernacle. And Elkanah would offer his sacrifices, and you'll read about that. But look at verse 6, the adversary here, principle of adversary. Verse 5 says, Hannah, he gave a worthy portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had shut up her womb, and her adversary also provoked her sore, for to make her fret, because the Lord had shut up her womb. And as he did so year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. And this is the story. And she would pray. And Eli, the priest, would sit up and see this. And in verse 9, you're introduced to him. And he'll see Hannah's lips moving, but her not saying anything audibly. She spake in her heart in verse 13. But Eli would mark her mouth in verse 12, and he thought she was a drunkard. So you got to be careful with what you think, right? Eli thought wrong. Hannah answered and said, "No, my Lord," in verse 15, "I'm a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord." So how important was it for these Jewish or Israelite tribes to come every year and perform their sacrifices on time, on schedule, according to their calendar? How important was that? It was commanded by the law. Where was God's presence and spirit represented? In the tabernacle, the Holy of Holies, right? And what box contained that spirit, that presence of God that the high priest was allowed to enter into once a year? The Ark of the Covenant. And so this is very important during this day and age. This is their religion. This is the way God organized it. This is the way God desired his people in this day and age to stay focused and not be distracted by all the gods that were surrounding them. Okay? And that's pretty important to emphasize, because we could talk about how Samuel will grow up in the house of the Lord with Eli. And we can talk about how God will reveal himself to Samuel. And Samuel will become the last judge, first prophet over Israel. But I want you to see something in chapter 4 of 1 Samuel. That in this setting, what is it that happens in chapter 4 of 1 Samuel? What happens to the Ark of the Covenant? That's right. Now, do y'all remember, do you remember I went to Arkansas, so I'm back into the y'all thing, so I'm back. I may have been saying that when I was here too, so. Anyway, do you remember when this ark is taken in this context, how long it takes to get it back? It's not 300. It's during that timeline when David goes back and gets it, and you remember they're bringing the ark back and the oxen there, and they're traveling, and the cart is tipping and stumbling, and the guy, what's his name?
Uzzah.
That's another one of those names you don't want to name your child, Uzzah. Poor guy. It takes a long time to go back and get this ark. Saul never gets this ark back. During Saul's timeline, Saul doesn't get this ark back. Now, that's always intrigued me, and I'll say that because that Ark of the Covenant represents something. And it's not in the tabernacle for all these years. So what were these priests doing for all these years at Shiloh in the tabernacle while that Ark of the Covenant sitting over in an idolatrous temple of Dagon? Dagon, right? Dagon. He's a fish god, if I remember. Well, that's what takes place right here during this timeline. Now, remember, the Ark of the Covenant was a central piece to help Israel stay focused. What was inside that ark?
Manna.
The rod that budded too, right? And that's gone. How important is that to their faith? To their remembrance of what God did for them, getting them out of the wilderness, out of Egypt? And that's God's presence. That's God's presence. Now, I wish I'd have never seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, that movie. Wished I'd have never seen that. You know why? Because it painted an image in my mind that I can't erase. And that's just a silly movie on archaeology and all that other stuff. I can't imagine what porn's doing to all these men that are addicted to that. But nonetheless, that's a side point. But it's nonetheless a true point to consider. But that movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, is embedded in my mind. How many of y'all have seen that? You know what I'm talking about? What scene do you remember? When those German Nazis got a hold of that ark, and actually it was old, what was his name? Indiana Jones. Yeah, he gets down to that old hole and there's snakes and stuff in there. And he finds that ark, right? But then the Nazis find him. And they get him out and he's confined and he's over there tied up and they're, don't look at it. And Indiana Jones is telling them, don't look at it. And he's kind of halfway quoting from the Old Testament scriptures. Something bad's fixing to happen. And sure enough, that old Nazi guy, whatever, dresses him up as a priest, I guess, a high priest. Y'all remember the scene? That's what movies in Hollywood do. But again, is that any of that true? That was all fake, okay? That's not true. The Ark of the Covenant was likely destroyed very simply during the Babylonian captivity period, if not before. Just destroyed. But here, that's very important to consider what's going on historically speaking. Historically speaking, and this is somewhere around 1,000+ years, 1,100 years before Christ. David is around 1,000 years. King David's around 1,000 before Christ. 1,000 BC is the timeline. And he's just a young little boy, may not even be born yet right here. And so that's what takes place in chapter 4. So the Philistines in chapter 5 get the Ark of the Covenant, and this is somewhat of a funny story. Yes.
I can mention something about how the children of Israel may have begun to look at the ark the way that other nations were looking at their gods.
Yes.
As the physical image itself was God, as they did Dagon and everything at this time when it was taken. How do you harmonize that with the idea of their view, if they view the ark as an idol, per se?
Not as the actual image or the presence of God.
Right. Then when it was gone, was God not with them, or was the view of that they had that God wasn't with them, or was it taken for them to see that that actually wasn't God, that the ark itself wasn't to be viewed as an idol?
Well, I think that it's an obstructed view. God allowed these physical things to happen to obstruct their view, because he will always bring them back to focus on a God who's actually in heaven, even though he'll utilize these things. Now, I can take this all the way to Christ. He allows his only begotten Son to become flesh, but the flesh of Christ became a distraction, even to the apostles or the disciples, when they're trying to cut off the ear of people and they're not getting the point. Jesus has been preaching, my kingdom is not of this earth. I'm going away. They're going to crucify me. The Jews themselves could not get their mind wrapped around the fact that Jesus in the flesh, the material, carnal, was not going to be a physical king. They wanted that physicality. And so even though God during this day and age chose an ark of the covenant, a physical tabernacle, to serve as a piece to keep them focused, Galatians 3:19 says that, well, what does it say? I don't remember. I know it's there. Galatians 3:19 and verse 24. Someone read those two passages to kind of help emphasize what I believe is going on right here. This physical period of time. But those who are faithful during this period of time are able to see past, I think like you're saying, Evelyn, the physical box, so to speak, and see that there's a God here that said to do it because he said to do it. What does verse 19 say, if you don't mind?
What purpose then does the law serve? It was added because of transgression till the seed should come to whom the promise was made, and it was appointed through angels by the hand of a mediator.
Okay, and now look at verse 24, these two passages here.
Therefore the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith.
Okay, so the law here will get us to Christ. All these bad things take place, like the ark now being taken, and they're like, whoa, the ark's gone. And it's a challenge of their faith. Our box is gone. Oh, Keith Mosier has a really good lesson on God in a box. Today, people still have God in a box. And he'll talk about God's not in a church building, but God is spirit. And he talks about the Ark of the Covenant, how it was a distraction, but yet it was God's means. Let me ask you a question. I don't want to diminish any commandment or authority of God, because I'm not. But in reality, we know that this physical bread and fruit of the vine is not physical blood and physical fleshly body of Jesus, right? Do we know that? But it's a memorial. It's supposed to serve as a memorial. But here's the question. Here's the question. Just like with the Ark of the Covenant. And you got to be careful with this question. Why, Jesus? Why? I'm not praying to Jesus, by the way. I'm just saying in my own study. Why, Jesus, did you commemorate a memorial feast or meal every first day of the week that's supposed to help me remember your flesh and your blood when it's just an unleavened piece of cracker today? And if you're not careful, you don't teach your kids right, they're going to think it's just a saltine. And the first time they wrap their lips around, they're going, ooh, there's no salt on it. By the way, salt is not a leavening agent. If you wanted salt on your unleavened bread, that would not de-leaven it. Is that right? You say that way? Unleaven it? Yeah. But we don't do that because, as one brother said up in Idaho, I was preaching a meeting and they ran out of their homemade leavened bread. And someone ran to the grocery store, got a box of unleavened bread, the crackers, came running back in the building, and I had to deal with this. On the box it said, not Passover worthy or something. You could not use this in the Passover. Oh, the guy said, well, we can't use that. And I said, why not? It says not Passover worthy on the box. And I said, well, I'm not taking the Passover in the Old Testament. I'm taking the Lord's Supper in the New Testament. Yeah, but it's a case. I said, so we did a little research. You know what that means when it says not Passover worthy? It's not blessed by a priest. What kind of priest? Well, I'm a New Testament priest, right? So I looked at that box of crackers and I went, hum, num, shibabi, lava, lava, lava. And I said, let's take and eat. No, I didn't do that for real, but I did say, we found out, but you know that brother still wouldn't let go of that? It violated his conscience. He wanted someone to make it in the church, a sister, to lay out some. So, there's a little issue, but anyway, we're having a little spiritual issue there. It really was a spiritual issue. But nonetheless, okay, so this right here we know, but we're still told to do it, aren't we? Why did God give them a box, Ark of the Covenant? I don't know. And I don't care, really. The older I get, I'm like, he said to do it. And I know some great things happened around that. And there was some manna put in there and some things that were miraculous that they were to remember. Okay? I could go on and on. But God said to do things. Why do we meet upon the first day of the week? This fruitcake Wes McAdams apparently just now wrote an article and said that giving on the first day of the week is not a command anymore. You keep listening to people like that, there won't be any authority to follow, except for him. I guess we're supposed to read every one of his articles. Well, you see my point? Well, baptism. Okay, baptism is a command of God, right? I've never had a good Baptist tell me it's not a command. I've asked them, is baptism a command? Yes. Why don't you do it? Well, it's not necessary. Well, when is a commandment of God necessary? You tell me, Mr. Authority. Now, you're the authority. I don't know. Well, it's a command of God, but here's the point, though. It's not just a blind command, though, is it? I could teach. My daughter Danielle's ready. I mean, I'm trying to teach her. I want her. She's young still, and she needs to grow and make sure she's ready to make good decisions. She knows it's a command of God. Okay? But does she understand what it means to crucify herself with Christ? You see, that takes a little bit more measure of faith here to understand the crucifixion. What was taking place there? What it means to be redeemed, bought back. She's still a sweet little innocent girl, and if she's not, don't tell me. I'm still a naive dad on her. But baptism in Romans 6 represents the death, the burial, resurrection of Jesus Christ, does it not? When you're buried with him in baptism, you arise to walk in a newness of life. But in reality, now again, if I just wanted to go through the motions and say, let's practice baptism. Are we baptizing people for the remission of their sins if we're just practicing baptism? Do you see where you have to be careful with that? But someone responds to the gospel this morning because they're listening and they hear the gospel and it still says, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. He says, I'm going to do that. In Colossians 2:12 helps me understand what's going on. By faith, Christ is doing an operation. An operation. Spiritual. 1 Peter 3:21, you got to keep studying your Bible to get the principle here to understand what's going on. Wherein doth now baptism save us? Not the putting away the filth of the flesh. It's not just practicing baptisms or taking a bath. But it is, when the person knows what they're doing, it is the answer of a good conscience according to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. You see the point? Now the box, the Ark of the Covenant, was it or was it not the place where God said, I will meet with you? And it was. Why? Because he said. Did some great things and powerful things come about due to that Ark of the Covenant? Yes, they did. When Uzzah touched it and did the wrong thing, did he die? He sure did. And that was then. So, does that somewhere, somehow answer the question? But in all these things, God allows sometimes us to be disrupted. He allows us to, because in reality, where is the throne of God and where has it always been? It's here. Can man destroy it? Man can't destroy the throne of God. Man been trying? Yeah. Satan been trying? Yeah. Trying to dethrone Christ? Can't do it, though. It's so interesting, the more I read my Bible, and I woke up this morning writing my own songs. I got song leading this morning, and I was singing to my kids, and I said, y'all sing with me. It's going to be a beautiful day, because we're going to worship God. I love the truth. The more I read this Bible, the more I fall in love with it. I do. Our God is an amazing, the only true and living God. So let's look at something that's interesting and kind of a little comical, if you will, in 1 Samuel chapter 5. Philistines, enemies of God, took the ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer unto Ashdod. When the Philistines took the ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon, or Dagon, and set it by their idols, Dagon. And when they of Ashdod arose early on the morrow, behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face to the earth before the ark of the Lord. They took Dagon and set him in his place again. When they arose early on the morrow morning, behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off upon the threshold. Only the stump, and you gotta love the King James Version, the stump of Dagon was left to him. Therefore, neither the priest of Dagon nor any that come into Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod unto this day. But the hand of the Lord was heavy upon them of Ashdod, and he destroyed them and smote them with emrods. That's an interesting study. Even Ashdod and the coast thereof. And when the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, the ark of the God of Israel. Notice how they're identifying that ark. Now, this box here, you ask, this box, did it represent some fish god? It was just a box. Had some cherubims. And I wonder, during this day and age of idolatry and paganism and polytheism and all these corrupt imaginations, I wonder if they were looking at Israel and going, these are just a bunch of dumb as rock people. I mean, they worship a box. We have a fish god. Come worship us. Come join our church. We got neat stuff. We got sphinxes and things that look like half lions and people. We're powerful. And the God of Israel says, you're going to build me a box. You see how this works? And all throughout time, God is doing that. And who will always win? God does. That's why it's so amazing to me when you take a Daniel, a prophet like Daniel, and you put him in Babylon. And Babylon, idol worshipers. And he's confronting Nebuchadnezzar over this dream that Nebuchadnezzar's having, right? And it's this amazing image and all these things of brass and gold and silver and iron. Well, iron was still kind of being, you know, beat out. They're still figuring that stuff out. And it gets down there at the bottom of that dream and it says, it's going to be some miry clay mixed into that iron. And these guys would understand what's going on. These guys that worked in metals. That's not good. And there's a God in heaven who's going to take a rock, a stone cut out, not with man's hand. And this rock, this simple rock, is going to destroy this image, but the reality, that rock is what's going to establish a kingdom that will never be destroyed. Daniel 2:44. And he destroys that great and powerful image by a little old rock. A little old rock. Same principle in the book of 1 Samuel. We hadn't got there yet, but we're fixing to. They're going to desire a king. Give us a king like all the other nations. And they get that chiseled jaw, good-looking Saul. What kind of a king is he? He can't even defeat the Philistines. And this guy named Goliath shows up. And he's taunting the army of the living God. That's what David will say. You're defiling my God. And they throw all this armor at little old David. And Saul says, give him my armor. Give him my big sword. Do you think Saul had the best sword in the whole army? He was the king, wasn't he? He special ordered that one. He said, give me the best. But go give it to David. Now maybe he's, just let David handle this one. And what does David kill that Goliath, that giant with? A little old smooth stone. Is that true or false? And who's the God that we serve? He's the God that says, here's my word. Don't be distracted by all this worldly stuff. Who's more powerful than all this goings-ons and all this other stuff? And yet he's the God that gave man the ability to engineer and master and build and do all these things. And all that stuff becomes a big old idol to us. A big old idol. Wow, look how powerful, man. Come join our church. Let's build a big old church building and call it this and call it that and set up this and set up that, and we'll give you what you want if you give us your money. It's the same old principle over and over again. But here again, God is not to be trifled with. Comments? All right, so we get through Samuel here. And the ark will be shuffled around. In chapter 7, 1 Samuel, trying to figure out what to do with this ark. It's the way people are today. They're still trying to figure out what to do with the truth. People today still trying to figure out what to do with God. They don't know him, do they? They don't know him. They're not listening. And so, 1 Samuel chapter 7, Samuel spake to all the house of Israel, verse 3, saying, if you do return unto the Lord with all your hearts, you see that? Then put away the strange gods and Ashtaroth from among you, and prepare your hearts unto the Lord, and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. Then the children of Israel did put away Balaam and Ashtaroth, and served the Lord only. And Samuel said, gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray for you unto the Lord. And they gathered together in Mizpah, and drew water, and poured it out before the Lord, and fasted on that day, and said there, we have sinned against the Lord, and Samuel judged the children of Israel in Mizpah. Remember, the ark is gone. Their box is gone. And they're remorseful. But this is chapter 7. And the children of Israel said to Samuel, verse 8, cease not to cry unto the Lord our God for us, that he will save us out of the hand of the Philistines. Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it for a burnt offering holy unto the Lord. And Samuel cried unto the Lord for Israel and said, Lord, and the Lord heard him. And as Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel. But the Lord thundered with a great thunder on that day upon the Philistines and discomfited them. They were smitten before Israel. Here's God saying, okay, I told you I would take care of you. Now I'm going to thunder. And he thunders. And what have they done? What have they done physically except showed humility, repentance? You remember God says that over and over again. What I really want is your heart. I want you to get out of my way and let my truth do the work. Think about how that works with gospel preachers, people today. We'll get out of the way and just preach the gospel. Preach the truth with love in our hearts, but nonetheless, preach it. My heart needs to be right? But preach it. Let God do the work. He'll do the saving. We'll stand back and we'll help and encourage people. Look at a memorial stone is set up in verse 12. The Philistines are subdued. And this is what you have. And then chapter 8. Time elapses here. Time is kind of our enemy, I think, sometimes. So it comes to pass. That's a phrase of time there in verse 1. Samuel's gotten old, and the ark's still gone, right? Still don't have the ark back. Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over him. This is the context. The elders of Israel, because his sons walked not in his ways, came to Samuel unto Ramah, verse 4, and said unto him, behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. Now I'll tell you what I think's happening here is fear. Fear. They're afraid. They're scared. Because they see the potential future. And they saw Samuel's sons, and they saw Samuel making a decision to put his sons in his place. And sometimes, dads, we need to pay attention to our children. Sometimes we need to pay attention to our children. Our children aren't necessarily the heirs of righteousness. Does that make sense?
One of the things that we notice here, there may well have been fear, but there was a lack of faith in God.
That's it.
If they had put their faith in God, God said, look, you know that Joel and Elijah are not what they need to be. God would say, be patient, I'll take care of it.
That's it. Every time.
They weren't patient.
And so, we let our fear trump over our faith. That's right. And that's a New Testament 1 John passage. Go read book of 1 John, and you'll see how that doesn't ever work in our favor. Got to be patient. When things are looking bad, we got to be patient. Don't let your fear outrun your faith. So they see that here, and their cry out is one of unfaithfulness. To make us a king like all the other nations, how do you think that affected God? I mean, he knew this was going to happen, but how does it affect Samuel?
Didn't like it.
No, Samuel didn't like it very, very much. Look at verse 7. And God always speaks the truth. The thing displeased Samuel in verse 6, but look at verse 7. The Lord said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they have to say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. So I want you to see that Samuel's being taught a lesson here too, but so are the Israelites. It's always that way. So according to all their works which they have done, since the day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, look at verse 9. Now therefore hearken unto their voice, howbeit yet protest solemnly unto them, Deuteronomy 17, preach the word, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. Now see, God had given them a revelation. So if you read verses 10 and following, you'll read about the high taxation. You'll read about him taking your sons, appoint them for himself. All these things, if you will read Deuteronomy 17, you'll see where God had said that. When you get that king that you're going to cry out for, this is what's going to take place.
Portion here is a good lesson for me as a parent to adult children. You know, when you're talking to your children and they're, you know, of course they're adults, they make their own decisions. Yes, you're going to give them, let them do whatever they want to do because they're adults, but at the same time, you protest. You make argument to them, especially if you know that the decision that they're making is not biblical, it's not sound, it's not right. In their minds, it's perfectly right. They see nothing wrong with it. And you're not there to tell them to make them not do it. You're there to just give them the advice or the instruction to say, okay, you do this, then this is what's going to happen. You do it, your decision, I'm telling you. You know, and it's a lesson to learn for all of us of how to transition to that. I think it was for me because it was very difficult. But God's basically saying, I'm giving you what you asked for, but you're going to get all the consequences that come with it, and here they are.
Yeah. I'm sitting here thinking through what this is what taught me mercy. I mean, it's probably what you're saying too, is that when I quit fighting, now you can't repeat this. This ain't about Gina this time. This is about Abby. But when I quit fighting with her, things got better because I was just fighting with her. She's headstrong. She's like her mama. No, I'm just teasing. She's like me. Kind of impetuous and doesn't think. And but yeah. Yeah. It's a good point. You know, and God gives us exactly what we ask for sometimes. Be careful what you pray for. May not be necessarily what God wants for you, but you might get it.
Doesn't kind of sound real familiar to what they're pushing for today? I need somebody to take care of me all the time. Well, this is what's going to happen if you go this route.
That's it.
We don't care.
We don't, and that's where you get really bad. When people say, oh, "I don't care anymore," that kind of cynical attitude. Well, I'm just not going to fight him. I don't care. Giving in, giving up, giving out. Yep. These lessons are still principles of God. That's what I want you to see. These are still principles of God. Do these principles still work today if we'll do what's right? Yes. Do they work against us if we do what's wrong? Yes. God's word is true. So they get what they want. I wanted to get to David, but I want to show you something real quick. Just look at 1 Samuel chapter 16. This is after the rejection of Saul for all the bad that he does. But I want you to see we're in 1 Samuel 16. Samuel is sent to Bethlehem and he is to anoint the new King David. And I want you to see Jesse. in verse 1. This is that person in the line of Ruth, remember? He says to Samuel, I will send thee to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king among his sons. Where is Jesus born, the babe? Bethlehem of old Judea. He says the prophets will preach. Anyway, don't forget to see that Jesus is born in Bethlehem. This is where David's from. And Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hear it, he will kill me. And the Lord said, take an heifer with thee and say, I am come to sacrifice to the Lord. And call Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show thee what thou shalt do. And thou shalt anoint unto me him whom I name. Now watch that. Him whom I name. Remember in chapter 8, well, give them what they want. Give them what they want, and they got Saul. And call Jesse, and I'll show you who I want. Samuel did that which the Lord spake in verse 4 and came to Bethlehem, and the elders of the town trembled at his coming and said, comest thou peaceably? That's a pretty cool passage to me. That shows a little bit of respect and reverence. The elders saw that Samuel had come, and they're like trembling. Are you coming peacefully? Are we in trouble? Why are you here? You think news traveled? Yeah, I don't think they had texting back then, but they had probably somebody running around talking. Verse 5, and he said, peaceably, I am come to sacrifice unto the Lord. Sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. And he sanctified Jesse and his sons and called them to the sacrifice. And it came to pass, when they were come, that he looked on Eliab and said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. The Lord said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. Look at the next phrase. For the Lord seeth not as man seeth, for man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart. How long is it going to take us to get that? I've seen more strength in the person who looks the weakest than I have the person who is the smartest and most intelligent, arrogant fool. The Lord looks on the heart. And it might take us a while to figure that out. That's why we ought to be patient there, Royce. Not be so quick to judge someone because he looks like the right fit. Anyway, sorry. Just got a little excited. Verse 8, then Jesse called Aminadab and made him pass before Samuel, and he said, neither hath the Lord chosen this. And then Jesse made Shema pass by, and he said, neither hath the Lord chosen this. And again Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel, and Samuel said unto Jesse, the Lord hath not chosen thee. And Samuel said unto Jesse, are here all thy children? And he said, well, there remaineth yet the youngest, and behold, he keepeth the sheep. And Samuel said unto Jesse, send and fetch him, for we will not sit down till he come hither. Now watch this. And he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy. I love the King James Version. I don't know what your modern day translation say, but I like ruddy. And with all of the beautiful countenance and goodly to look to, and the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. I love that, man. And I hope that you do too. And that's going to be your king that we're going to study more and more and get us to the divided kingdom, to Solomon. Hope that study has been helpful to you. I appreciate the attention.